Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate y'all tuning in. Check out my website, scotthorton.org. Follow me on, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, subscribe to me on YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. All right, first guest today is Francis Nesbitt, and he is at the Department of Africana Studies at San Diego State University. And he's got book chapters and articles in, Foreign Policy and Focus and 10 other journals around the world as well. Welcome back to the show. Francis, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you very much for joining us today. There are very few people who can speak well on America's intervention, Western intervention in Somalia, over the last few years, and I was very impressed by what you had to say when we spoke before, so I really appreciate you being available for us today. I guess the recent word is that Ethiopia has now, is it re-invaded Somalia? And then is that at the behest of the United States again?
Yes, Ethiopia has its troops have been integrated into AMISOM, which is a African Union mission in Somalia, which is funded by the United States and other Western nations. And so, in a way, yes, they are working at the behest of the United States foreign policy. So, since the 2006 invasion, the first invasion at the behest of the Bush administration was in 2006, they were forced to leave in 2009. But since then, the main point is that they have been unofficially within Somalia. So what they've done is just made it official. They say 4,300 and some troops are going to be integrated into the AMISOM force. Well, we know that there have been more than 4,000 troops from Ethiopia inside Somalia over the last few years. So they have had many incursions into Somalia territory. So what they've done now is just made it official.
I see. So it's not really a re-invasion. This is still the re-invasion because they did leave right after 2008 and then they came back, two or three years ago, correct? Or
right,
they really
right.
have been there all along?
Yes, exactly. They've been there all along. They've been operating there. The United States is operating a drone base within Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. That's where the drone attacks come from. And so they've been involved for a long time. In fact, even the troop numbers we are being given by the United Nations of 4,395 seem a little low. So they have been there for a while. And so what is happening now is that by being integrated into AMISOM, they're following the example of Kenya, it's Kenya which invaded Somalia, and then a year later in 2011 was integrated into AMISOM, and that means that they will have funding, that is, instead of them funding Ethiopia or Kenya, funding the operations within Somalia, it is now funded by the United Nations.
Mm. All right, now... let's talk about the most important thing really first is, I guess, the weather and the state of the crops and the famine right. there. How over is it?
Well, it's famine time again, and there's a lot of difficulty. And there seems to be some problems in Al-Shabaab-controlled areas within Somalia, where, recently they expelled various international NGOs. And so this is this is, as we talked about, I think, was it last year we talked about when the same similar thing happened? This is the serious problem here, in the sense that aid operations are not able. Well, first of all, there's a drought, so people are not able to. This is the time when they plow the land in order to seed it. And if they're not able to do that, there'll be a disaster within 3 months or so. So it's unfortunate that the conflict is going on right now, which is hindering the humanitarian operations. So this is going to have a major impact if the international community doesn't take action now.
Yeah, well, I guess it was last spring or early last summer that FuseNet, which is, I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's an American and British sponsored, you know, so-called NGO type organization that monitors famines around the world. And they said that approximately their measure was 260,000 Somalis had died in the famine. And then the majority of those were children under the age of five, they said.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's there have been these reports over the years. It's, you know, the farmers have to be able to plow the land at a particular time in anticipation of the rains. And if conflict blocks that that operation, it becomes, you know, it's a disaster, but it is a disaster that is predictable.
Right.
So the part of the support for Ethiopia and for AMISOM comes from some of these organizations that think that if they could stabilize the situation in time, then it might be possible to avert another major disaster that has occurred last year.
Well, it's certainly true that the war, I mean, I guess, you know, in 2010 and 11, the whole Horn of Africa was hit with the bad weather, but the famine hit Somalia the hardest because, as you said, the instability, the inability for, you know, farmers to just go out and sow their crops and then for that matter, their ability to get them to market or anybody at the market to buy what they have to sell. I mean, the whole division of labor is completely destroyed in the war there. And certainly that's why it hit them so hard. So now I guess you sound like you're saying that the situation is so bad that really probably the best bet for staving off another renewed famine of those kinds of numbers of dead would be for the outside interventionists, the Americans and the African Union, to win, basically, to get it together enough that they can really conquer the whole country, eliminate al-Shabaab and any of the conflict, you know, peace in total victory, and then maybe they'll be able to deliver some food aid. Is that really right? I mean, I would think that if we're the ones who made it this bad, maybe we should just knock it off.
The thing is that if it gets to the point, what I'm saying is, if, let's say, the farmers are not able to go and sow their crops this year, then it will get to a situation where the international community will be forced to intervene because there'll be mass starvation. Right? So, as we've discussed before, the issue in Somalia is how to develop a stable Somali state that can secure itself and take care of these kinds of issues. Mm. Right? That's the ultimate goal, to have the Somali military built up and the state built up to such a where they can actually take control of their territory.
Is the government in Mogadishu, are they willing to try to negotiate with the al-Shabaab insurgency, or their policy is just win or lose, keep fighting forever?
No, the Somali state has negotiated with factions of al-Shabaab. You know, al-Shabaab is not a monolithic entity. They have negotiated with factions. One of the leaders, Hassan Al-Waiz, last year actually defected from al-Shabaab too, and he has a strong militia to the Somali government, and is cooperating with the Somalia government currently. So, Yes, they are willing to negotiate with certain factions. And as you know, the Al-Shabaab itself has been weakened and fragmented since the Kenyan incursion into Kismayo. They lost their main source of funding, which is the port of Kismayo, where they, you know, ran smuggling operations. So what has happened is that the Al-Shabaab has fractured so that they are the internationalists under Modane, who is the current de facto leader of Al-Shabaab. And then there are others who are nationalists who would like to take over the Somalia government. So this is the situation. There are certain factions which are willing to negotiate with the Somalia government, and those talks are ongoing. The other factions that are, for instance, the internationalists who might not be interested in, you know, negotiations with the government, and, you know, so because their goals are different. So, so it's a fluid situation politically.
Well, now, and when you talk about the internationalized, you mentioned last time that we spoke that when the Kenyans took the port town of Mogadishu, that was their income was the charcoal business and all of that. And so they had to turn to outside donors to survive. But that came with changing their position about who exactly their enemy was. And that was what kind of internationalized them. So then do I read you right that that means Saudis?
Yes, certain Saudi-based groups, the Salafists and so on, not just Saudi, but, you know, all over the Middle East and the world, there are groups that are willing to fund attacks on Westerners in East Africa. So they are appealing to those groups by attacking, for instance, Westgate Mall in Kenya. That is a fundraising exercise that is seeking support from these international organizations that are calling them internationalists, right? Whereas the traditional Islamists in Somalia were funded by local businessmen and of course the smuggling operations at Kismayo, not Mogadishu, by the way, it's Kismayo, the port that Kenyans took over. So this is so there are various factions within Al-Shabaab. The internationalist one is the one that conducted the attacks on Kenya, and it seems to be ascendant, at least within Somalia. Mm-hmm. At least that's where the funding is coming from. Whereas the nationalists have really lost the battle in Somalia.
Now we got to hold it right here and go out to this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Francis Nesbitt from the Department of Africana Studies at San Diego State University. And yeah, I'm sorry if I said Mogadishu when I meant Kismayo. I get that wrong. One time I said World War II ended in 1845, and I didn't even notice until the next day. We'll be right back after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right. Welcome back to the show, everybody. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. ScottHorton.org is my website. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003. No, really. ScottHorton.org. And also you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. All right. We're in the middle of talking with Francis Nesbitt. He's a professor there in San Diego and an expert on the war still raging after all these years, or I don't know how raging it is, but it's still going on in Somalia there. And where we left off, we were talking about the split between the internationalists and the nationalists. But, you know, I'm curious, back, it would have been 2010 or 11, I think, there was an attack on a Ugandan, I guess, a restaurant where people were gathered around watching the soccer game on TV. And at the time, at least, my best understanding of that wasn't so much that Al-Shabaab had become an internationalized movement as much as this was direct revenge for the Ugandans shelling a soccer field outside of Mogadishu and killing a bunch of children of just a few weeks before. And they said, okay, well, we're going to bomb you back. And it was just a strict matter of blowback. But then I hear you cite the attack on the mall in Kenya as a real change in direction. So it must be more than just the act that makes you say that that's more than just revenge for what Kenya is doing in Somalia right now, but that it it marks a real change in their strategy, their plans for the future, that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely. Since the Ugandan bombing, the Al-Shabaab has changed in character. The Ahmed Godane, who was a leader within Al-Shabaab earlier, has taken power. And Ahmed Godane is known to be an internationalist rather than a nationalist. That is, he eliminated his rivals within Al-Shabaab and has consolidated his power over the organization. So at the same time, there's the other factor, which is the fact that they lost Kismayo and they lost their major source of funding. By losing Kismayo and a couple of other ports to the Kenyan forces. And so Al-Shabaab has, at least the official arm, has been forced to seek funding elsewhere. And the internationalist faction, which includes, by our reports, at least 100 international jihadists who are not particularly interested in taking over the Somali state, but are more interested in attacking Western targets in the region. You know, they are more they are internationalists, and they are the ones now who are bringing in the funding, right? Terrorism thrives on funding, you know. So these are the ones that funded the Westgate Mall attack, and this faction seems to be more ascendant in even within Somalia itself. So there is this split, and we saw that, as I mentioned earlier, with the defection of Hassan Awes to the Somali government. I mean, he gave himself up last year to the Somali government. He was a member of Al-Shabaab. He brings, you know, he has a leader of a major clan militia. And so, you know, you can see this process where the pressure that has been put on Al-Shabaab has led to this internationalist faction being the dominant faction.
Right. Okay, now, this is sort of a two-parter about Somali public opinion, and I guess we're excluding Somaliland and Puntland from this, and we're just talking about, I guess, the rest of Somalia is really what's in question, right? And then, so the question is public opinion in favor of what Al-Shabaab is doing at all, and or it could be related, but it could be also sort of be a separate question of whether they support the so-called government in Somalia that the internationals have come in and, you know, put in place there for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fluid situation. The Al-Shabaab has made a bad name for itself by imposing extreme Sharia at the behest of their international donors, of course, the Wahhabis and so on, the, you know, beheading people and stonings and amputations, you know, banning music, banning movies and so on. And so there is that discontent with Al-Shabaab, especially in areas where they are not the clan leaders in those particular areas. At the same time, there is discontent with the government of Somalia, which also has its problems. It's unable to secure the country, and it's unable to provide any forms of services, you know, to its constituents. So, so it's a fluid situation. And this situation could change, and that's why this problem with the current incursion of the Ethiopian troops into Somalia, its integration into AMISOM, could change. The situation could change people's minds, because Ethiopia is a traditional enemy. It's considered a Christian state. You know, they've had the war, you know, the Ogaden War in 1976-77, the 2006 invasion, and, you know, they have had a, it's a traditional enemy in the region. So this situation could lead to, in some areas, particularly the Ogaden area and in the Ogaden clan, to support, further support for Al-Shabaab.
Right.
Because of these Ethiopian, the presence of Ethiopian troops within Somalia.
Right. Yeah, it's just another chapter in the same thing, the intervention making it all worse, creating this problem in the first place. I think if I'm hearing you right, what you're saying is, just like we've seen in Iraq and just like we've seen in Syria, these, you know, Sunni-based insurgents or, you know, Al-Qaeda-type guys, they wear out their welcome among the local population real quick when, you know, they're nothing but an insurgency and they act like they're already the dictatorship and they just, you know, turn people against them. They marginalize themselves, but then here comes the cavalry to come
right.
and give people a reason to support them again in the form of Ethiopia's renewed invasion. I mean, this is how Al-Shabaab grew up from nobody to somebody in the first place, was in the fight
right.
against the Ethiopians back in 2006 through 8, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Al-Shabaab emerged after the Ethiopian troops crushed the Islamic Coast Union, and then the militarized faction of the Islamic Coast Union was Al-Shabaab, and this is its origin. That resentment of Ethiopian invasion, and of course, it was a horrible mistake in 2006, the 2006 invasion, which was supported by the United States and the George Bush administration, because they destroyed the only credible structure that existed at the time in Mogadishu, that is a political structure, and then it led to the further radicalization of Al-Shabaab and the emergence of Al-Shabaab. So, yes, so this kind of cycle is, as you've just pointed out, quite prevalent around the world. You know, you invade, occupy a country, leads to resentment, and the terrorist groups count on that. You know, for instance, the Westgate Mall attack was designed to get the United Kenyan government and its allies in the U.S. and the West, so on, to overreact to this act and crack down on Somalis and other Muslims in Kenya, which leads to resentment and leads to possibly an insurgency within Kenya. You know, this is what is this is the strategy used by some of these groups, that especially the internationalist groups. You know, they want to create resentment of Muslims for these countries like Kenya and so on, and Ethiopia, which would lead to more support for their cause. So that's the danger with the current Ethiopian integration into AMISOM. At the same time, as I mentioned earlier, there's, you know, it's balanced by this other issue, which is that the continued intransigence of Al-Shabaab in many parts of southern Somalia is likely to lead to another famine. And therefore, it seems to me that AMISOM and the African Union leaders have made this Faustian bargain. You know what? You know, they are caught within a rock and a hard place, and the decision was to integrate Ethiopia. But like I said earlier, this has been going on for a while. You know, Ethiopian troops, more than 4,000 troops, have made incursions inside Somalia several times, especially in that western region. They're simply formalizing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it sounds like I guess it's just proven again that the biggest threat to regular people is being caught between the terrorists and the government, because if, as you say, which I think you're right, that most terrorist acts are meant toward provoking an overreaction, the 99 times out of 100 or more probably, any government in question, you know, ex-government would love the opportunity to overreact, no matter what the excuse is, in order to expand their power. So these guys can just go back and forth, you know, ultimately until the empire's completely bankrupt and it all falls apart, you know, and the rest of us, the Somalis will starve to death. The Americans, we don't have it quite that bad, but we have to suffer. Well, I guess some Americans are starving over it. We have to suffer a lot of consequences ourselves, but our government is really, you know, we always argue about whether it's stupidity or the plan. All of our government's terrible policies seem to benefit them, if not the national interest, incidentally. Right. So I think they maybe they're stupid, but they're stupid in their own special ways that benefit themselves a lot of the time.
Yeah, of course, they make these decisions that benefit their donors. You know, I mean, war is business. At the end of the day, war is a great business. Some people are making great money. We're not just talking about the American corporations here that make the weapons and the guns and the bombs and the jet fighters and so on, but also locally, you know, in Iraq, in Somalia, and elsewhere, there are people who are laughing all the way to the bank.
Yep. Afraid so. All right, and I'm also afraid that I blew this break and we're way over time here, but thank you so much for your time on the show today, Francis. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. That is Francis Nesbitt. He is a professor in San Diego at San Diego State University, Department of Africana Studies there. And sorry, here's the news. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org.